Facebook.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Art Pope is a successful businessman. Chairman, CEO, and president of Variety Wholesalers, his company runs stores like Roses and Maxway. Art Pope is a conservative who puts his money where his mind is. He has fueled think tanks like the John Locke Foundation and the Civitas Institute and political campaigns for party leaders in the state. Art Pope has been a legislator who championed reforms to the state's budget and tax system. And today, Art Pope is North Carolina's budget director and has helped craft at least one version of the state's proposed budget. But Art Pope is also controversial. The state Senate threatened to subpoena him over Medicaid numbers, and there's even a website called Art Pope Exposed, which outlines numerous sins as seen by those behind the site. But Art Pope is also a man who a lot of North Carolinians really don't know at all. While budget negotiations continue in the state legislature, we thought it would be a good time to listen back to our conversation with Mr. Pope, recorded in April. So we'll do just that this hour. We welcomed him by phone from Raleigh.
Good morning, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
I just went through a very truncated resume, and I mentioned that despite your position, many people don't know you. They've never heard of you. So for those people, what should we know about you?
Well, Mike, I think your summary is pretty accurate. I grew up in North Carolina from the small town of Fuquay Springs, and later my family moved to Raleigh. Went to public schools and private schools, attended the University of North Carolina undergraduate and Duke Law School. Practiced law for several years. When I first took time out from my law practice to work in public service, I was a special counsel to Governor Jim Martin back in 1985. I then joined our retail family business after that back in 1986, and then went on to serve in four terms in General Assembly while staying with the family business. And by the way, despite all some of the partisan rhetoric, I was one of the first Republicans elected from Wake County to the legislature in the 20th century, and my district was overwhelmingly Democratic. If I did not have Democrat votes, I would never have been elected to General Assembly. One of the first things I did as a freshman representative in 1989 was join a bipartisan coalition to elect the reformer Joe Mavretic as Speaker of the House. Joe was, of course, a Democrat. So I've had a long-time history of public service. Our family did start, and I headed up the John William Polk Foundation. And since 1986, we've given $100 million to charity. Those were traditional humanitarian charities to help clothe people, indigent health care, education, as well as public policy. And public policy can and should be part of charitable giving. I believe very strongly in helping those in need, treating the symptoms of poverty. But more importantly, you need to treat the underlying causes of poverty. And I believe promoting public policy that respects the rights of the individual, the voluntary changes of a free market economy, subject to the rule of law, is the most productive economy. That's what gives people the opportunity to rise out of poverty. And it's better to cure poverty than simply treat the symptoms of poverty, though we do both.
You know, as we said, you're a relatively wealthy man by common person's standards, and you've been a very successful businessman, and you run a very successful business, or at least you did until you became the budget director. Why take the time out of your life and take it away from your own ability to earn as much money as possible, which is, I think, many people's goals, to do what you do for the state? Why do that?
If the way I was raised is what I believe, I think everyone should dedicate part of their time to public service. And I've done that both through my service in the legislature, served to Jim Martin as his special counsel, and right now I'm serving as a volunteer. I get paid nothing to be state budget director. So I do believe in helping society, helping other individuals. I have been fortunate. By the way, you refer to me being wealthy, and yes, I am. I did not inherit my business. For some reason, some of those left-wing critics you mentioned like to paint me as being born of a silver spoon with inherited wealth. Well, I was born and lived in a small town, again, Fuquay Springs, in a rental house until my family moved to Raleigh. And I've earned my wealth. I did not inherit anything from my father. Well, I hope I inherited his good judgment and wisdom, but financially he left all his assets, unfortunately passed away, but he left all his assets to my mother as he should have and then to charity. So I do have the ability to volunteer both my own time and through our family foundation to give to charities, and so that's what I choose to do.
Mm. And I want to repeat the fact that you said, and I think we heard you correctly, you are not getting paid to be the budget director for the state of North Carolina. What does that position normally pay?
It normally pays around $120,000, $130,000 a year.
And you're doing it gratis?
I'm doing it gratis. I'm giving up that salary.
What exactly does the budget director do?
The state budget director, and more importantly, the Office of State Budget Management, because I have a very good, excellent professional staff. I don't think Andy Willis, the former budget director, who helped on transition and had recruited a very good staff, maintained a good staff. We're responsible in phases. First of all, we prepare and recommend a budget for the governor. I work directly with the governor preparing that budget. The governor complains about the hours I keep him in a hot, stuffy room going over our staff, all the decisions that need to be made and what the recommended budget will be. That's the first step. The second step is working with the legislature when they're presented the budget or the enactment of the budget. The third step is called, a rough name called certification, where we then take the enacted budget, then certify it, and start administering that budget to all the departments and agencies and allocating their money during the course of the year. We're responsible for changes in the budget that are allowed by the department and agency throughout the year. And then we have to close out the budget at the end of the year, just like a private business does, closes out their accounts at the end of the year, and then report back everything that's going on in state government, of course, to the governor who directly oversees us, but also to the General Assembly. Then we start the cycle over again with the next year's budget.
So you're pretty much working, even though we're not always in budget season, you pretty much you can fill the calendar, so to speak.
Yes, many people seem to think that all the budget office does is prepare a recommended budget. No, we administer the budget that's enacted into law.
Mm. Now, the governor wanted, one of the things he talked about when he was running, wanted to overhaul the tax code. And I know that you, as a legislator, also wanted to overhaul the tax code. And some of the changes, some changes were made this year in the tax code. And you wrote an opinion piece that would appear yesterday, I believe, in the Raleigh News and Observer, in which you said tax reform is working for working families in North Carolina. Tax reform means lower sales taxes and income tax rates for everyone. Tax reforms, as enacted by Governor McCrory and the General Assembly, means workers and their families keep more of their hard-earned dollars to spend or save as they choose, and employers keep more of their hard-earned dollars to reinvest to create more jobs and grow the economy. Our tax code is now simpler, more uniform, and fairer for everyone. But not everyone agrees with that. Why?
Well, there are some that just want to criticize whatever is done by the McCrory administration Republican legislature. But if you looked at the facts, look at all the analysis by the professional staff of the General Assembly, by the professional staff of the Office of State Budget and Management, by the independent studies, everyone has benefited from the tax reductions, especially when you start with the sales tax was reduced in 2011. The sales tax reached a peak of 5.75%. That's just the state sales tax. You add on the local sales tax at 7.75%, then a few counties like Mecklenburg even have a tax on top of that. That is a regressive tax. And some of the liberal progressive groups that complain about the regressive sales tax, I agreed with them. I agreed with them when I was a legislature and voted against those tax increases when they were repeatedly increased by the Democratic Party. So what we have done, what the Republican legislature did before Governor McCrory became in office in 2011, was reduce that 17%. That's an across-the-board savings for every family. They have more money to spend because they pay less in the sales tax. Once the sales tax was done, we also had a very high income tax, both personal income tax and corporate income tax, which made it hard to compete for the neighboring states, and again meant the employers and their employees had less income to invest and spend. So the second step was to lower those tax rates. Now, I could talk for hours on the 2013 legislative session because there were probably three, four, five different competing plans. But the plan that was enacted did try to carefully balance making the tax simpler by lowering the rates to a single flat rate of 5.8% this year. But it also raised the standard deduction and specific tax credits, such as the child tax credit, make sure those at the low income range also receive the savings. Now, some have made analysis claiming that some paid higher tax increase. You can find in individual family circumstances that they may have lost some deductions, have some particular business transaction, which is now taxed higher. But in the population as a whole and in the aggregate overall, the low income and middle income are saving hundreds of millions of dollars under tax reform. It's not just the high income individuals across the board.
And as you've mentioned, that there are people who have been critical of this, and you address one of the criticisms in your op-ed piece in the NNO by saying that North Carolina's tax reform has been criticized for benefiting those who earn and save more of their income. It's not favoritism, you say. It's basic math. Those who earn more and pay a higher tax will logically benefit more from a rate reduction than those who paid at a lower rate or who paid no income tax at all. When you look at it explained that way, it becomes almost indefensible just to be on the other side, it seems to me. But why do people complain about that, in your view?
Again, most of the ones that are complaining are the organized policy groups left of center. And I think they just want to criticize and tear down the current administration, the current governor, rather than have an honest debate on what the facts are and what the best policy is.
But then there's the other side of the coin, and that is if you take in less, if you're smart, you have to spend less. And the state has said in many cases, and we can get into specifics later on, that there is not money for this, there's not money for that. And critics will say, well, there's not money for this and that because you have decided that you don't want to bring in any money.
Well, some legislators had tax reform proposals, tax cut proposals, which would have cost the state much more than what was enacted. And Governor Corey said, no, we will have reasonable tax reform. We will make sure that we have enough money to fund the needs of the state and growth in the state. Because in the short term, when you cut rates, you do reduce revenue. There's no doubt about that. Now, in the long term, as those rates are reduced, the money that is saved by the individuals, employers, employing more people, get reinvested in the economy, and North Carolina becomes more competitive and our industry and jobs grow, then we will have more revenue because we have a stronger economy for on which the taxes are based. So in the long term, we do believe it will be economic growth and more state revenue due to tax reform. But yes, during the short term, you do lose revenue, but that's why we were very careful to limit how much revenue is going to be lost. Mm-hmm. We will still have growing income in the state, and we were still working very hard. That's why in this job as budget director, I have to deal with both sides of the coin, the revenue and the expenditures, to have a balanced budget that meets our needs. But we're working very hard to meet those needs. The two top obligations this year and every year, but this year in particular, as usual, is Medicaid, because there's a growing cost of the state, growing expenditure, and we have to meet those obligations and entitlement. But the second high priority, and I'll say as high priority, is a pay increase for teachers and state employees. And I know a lot of people are expressing doubt as to whether or not we can do that this year. Well, Governor Corey is working very hard in this budget to make sure we have a good pay increase for both teachers and state employees.
That's State Budget Director Art Pope, recorded in April. Of course, the legislature is still negotiating details of the $21.1 billion budget, and two of the biggest hurdles have been those priorities that Art Pope just mentioned, funding Medicaid and how to handle the teacher pay increase. We're coming back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Blue Bloods on WBTV. Tonight's episode is at 10, followed by WBTV News at 11. Reporting facts, getting answers, finding solutions. WBTV on your side.
We'll have more of our encore edition of Charlotte Talks here on WFAE in just a moment. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, the budget, teacher pay, and coal ash are just three things that have been occupying North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory's time and attention. But he also says he's concerned about economic development and infrastructure improvements. And he wants to work on the Career Pathways Plan to give young people the skills needed in a 21st century workforce and which would make North Carolina more competitive. Governor McCrory joins us. He'll talk about all of that and more when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama asks Congress for nearly $4 billion to address the border crisis. The House and Senate moved to renew the Highway Trust Fund, and recreational marijuana sales began in Washington State.
Join the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Let's get back to our conversation with North Carolina Budget Director Art Pope, which we recorded in April. The budget, of course, remains in the spotlight as the House and Senate spar over negotiations. But when we left off, we were talking about tax policy and tax changes that have gone into effect this year. Art Pope, since he was a legislator, has long been an advocate for tax reform in North Carolina. And I asked him what he thinks was wrong or is wrong with our tax structure here.
The old tax structure was started in the 1930s, and it may have been fitted for a 1930s economy. It was not fitted for either 1990s or the 2000s economy. From the time I was in the legislature, we had a big increase in revenue, and that ratcheted up spending, and then we hit a downturn in the economy in 1991, and the bottom fell out. We had to cut back in the middle of the year. That same thing happened in 2001. Big increase in spending, and then the economy fell off, the revenue fell off even more sharply, and we had to cut back to hardship in the middle of the year. Then again in 2008, 2009, the Great Recession. So the tax system we had was very volatile. It also was punitive at the margins. The sales, the income tax kept getting raised to the point, at one point, it was at 8.25%, one of the highest tax rates in the country. So it discouraged people from locating in North Carolina. It encouraged people to relocate their businesses outside the state, to retire to Florida with no income tax. So we were seeing a loss in economic production. But also, as I said, we had a very regressive tax as well in the sales tax, because the sales tax was on a very narrow base on goods, not on any services. And you saw the sales tax increase, state sales tax increase from 4% in 1991, excuse me, from 3% in 1991 to 5.75% under the peak in 2010. So that was regressive sales tax. So what tax reform sought to do was, one, to lower that regressive sales tax back down a full percentage point, a 17% reduction, simplify and lower the personal income tax and corporate income tax rates to single flat rates, but also broaden the base, make laws more uniform and broaden the base. That was President Reagan's definition of tax reform. So there was some broadening the base, including taxing certain services that were already related to goods being sold. So, for example, a movie theater, which charged you a sales tax when you bought the popcorn and the soft drink inside the theater, now has to charge the same uniform sales tax on the ticket when you enter the theater. When you go to an electronics store and buy electronic items, cell phones, MP3 players, they always want to sell you a service contract as well. And most of us know the service contract is really a down payment when the darn thing breaks. But the service contract wasn't subject to a sales tax, even though the original purchase of the item was. So we extended the sales tax to the service tax. So by broadening the base and simplifying the rules, we were able to pass tax reform to make the economy more stable and still provide for our future economic growth and increase revenues to fund state government.
Now, you've wanted to do this for a long time, and as budget director, one would assume that you have a lot of influence on changing policy, either through the governor's office and working with the governor, who you appear to be on the same page with regard to this, and through the legislature, because you're the budget director and you meet with the legislature on a regular basis, or at least somebody from your office does. So is being budget director a way for you to have more influence over tax policy and budget policy than ever before?
Well, you make it, you personalize it, which is flattering. But for tax reform, Governor Jim Hunt had as a major goal of his administration tax reform. He cited the antiquated system. He had blue ribbon commissions. And after he was no longer governor of the Emerging Issues Forum, which he has looked at tax reform, Governor Easley said we need an antiquated tax system. He had blue ribbon commissions. So the need for tax reform has been well recognized by all parties, Democrat and Republican leaders beforehand. What was different this year is we were able to actually accomplish it for the first time in decades, the first really big change since the 1930s. And then we had a bill called Senate Bill 51 in 1989. But since that Senate Bill 51, this is the first major rewrite. And it was, by the way, I did have a role as state budget director representing Governor McCrory in the Governor McCrory's direction. But we had a very open debate in the legislature. Within the debate on tax reform, even on the conservative side of tax reform, there are those at the national and the state level propose a consumer tax. They want to abolish the income taxes altogether and just have a sales tax on all services.
Which is regressive. What people would say, that's regressive.
Which is regressive. And it's almost like having a gross income tax by the time you tax every transaction. But there are proponents for that at the national level. They call it the fair tax.
Where do you come down on that?
No, the governor came down against that. More importantly, not where I come down, it's where the governor comes down. He came down against, there's legislation that proposed to do that, and the governor came down against that because it would have been such a high tax rate, and it would have been regressive. And it's not completely balanced. So what the governor came out in support for and what I worked with the legislators was a more like the simple tax, flat tax, where we flatten the tax rates and broaden the base. That this way you have a balance. You still have the state drawing in revenue from sales tax with a broader base, but not all services. If we still exempt food and medicine, for example. You then have the personal income tax. And by the way, even though it's called the personal income tax, most small businesses that are organized as a sole proprietorship, the mom-and-pop business, partnerships, LLC, they're taxed at the personal rate. Their rate's lowered, and that's where most of the jobs are created by those small businesses. But a lot of the large businesses and even small businesses are what are called C corporations. They pay the corporate tax rate, and we were uncompetitive there. So we kept a balance between those three taxes, but simplified and broadened the base. We think that would be less volatile, more assured income, steady growth, but not the big swings up and down that we've seen saw in the old tax code.
I want to get back to this lag time between cutting the tax rates and spreading the base, the tax base, and the fact that that temporarily, at least in your opinion, is bringing in a little less money than perhaps it will eventually. Both you and the governor believe that the state's budget has to shrink as well. The size of government has to shrink in order to revive the economy. And the governor stressed at one point that the state's budget forecast is uncertain because of something you alluded to a moment ago, Medicaid expenses, and the fact that recent winter weather might have reduced tax collections. I mean, that was when I saw that in the paper, that kind of raised my eyebrows, went up, because I thought, really? A couple of winter storms are going to – we're so tight on the budget that a couple of winter storms are going to throw us into a tax collection tizzy? Isn't that cutting the margins too thin?
Well, we haven't cut the margin that thin. Actually, as of the end of March – the revenue collected is almost exactly on budget. We're actually about $12.6 million over budget for collections for revenue at the end of March. That's after the winter storms. We were $100 million over budget at the end of December. So we went from $100 million budget to $12 million over budget, but still on budget, which is an increase over the previous year. And we do think part of that was for the winter storms. And overall, Mike, you said that we want to shrink government. Government should be right-sized to meet its needs, but overall the state budget is still growing. The big drop in the state budget came under Governor Perdue and the Democratic legislature in 2009 and 2010 after the Great Recession started. It's understandable why, because the entire economy was contracting and the state budget contracted. But the state budget has continued to increase. And even with tax reform and the rate reductions, which means everyone has more money in their pockets, but state government has less money, we have less money from an increased growth. Normally, the budget grows at about 3.5%. With the tax reform in place, the revenue next year is probably going to be at about 2.6%, 2.7%. And then it will slowly build back up to that 3.5% and higher. So revenue is still coming in a higher amount. The growth is still there. It's just not as much growth. So as we have recovered from the recession, as we are rebuilding our education system, as we're pouring more money into our physical infrastructure, as we rebuilt the savings reserve account, it's also appropriate to give people relief from those higher taxes that were passed before so they can rebuild their family budget, they can rebuild their business budget, and invest more and create more jobs and growth.
Well, as I understand it, these changes in our tax laws have raised us now from 44th place to 17th in terms of having a favorable tax climate for business. But as we've said, it's also temporarily resulted in a drop of revenue. North Carolina's nonpartisan fiscal research team estimates that the state will bring in about $2 billion fewer dollars over the next 5 years. In an economy recovering from an extended recession, is that something we can really afford?
But again, what is your baseline? That's $2 billion less dollars than the expected growth. It's not $2 billion less than this year. So the budget will still grow hundreds of millions of dollars each year, but instead of being, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but sure, instead of having $6 billion more 5 years from now, we'll have about $2 billion more. So the budget, the revenue is still growing, just not going to grow quite as fast. The state budget's not going to grow quite as fast. Again, I'm repeating myself, so the families can have more of their money, their family budgets can grow.
We're talking to State Budget Director Art Pope today on WFAE Charlotte Talks. Is this just a start? What has been enacted this year, the changes in the tax code, is this just a start? Do you hope that it goes elsewhere? Do you have an idea where you'd like it to go? Does the governor, are you on the same page with that? Where does all this stand?
The governor has been very firm that the tax reform we have right now is it for the time being. There can be no major changes in the tax code proposed by the governor in the short session that starts in May, nor is there any indication from the General Assembly they're going to increase for it. We need to see how these tax reforms work, see the real economic growth is there before there are any further tax changes. And there is uncertainty because right now, while some revenue is increasing as expected, like the sales tax, the withholding tables are having us withhold less money so people have more money in their paycheck, and that may mean they have less refunds next year, but right now the state's not getting as much from the withholding. It surprised me. North Carolina taxpayers are very generous. They overpay their taxes by about $2.2 billion a year. That's essentially a tax-free loan from the taxpayers to the state of North Carolina, which we then pay back between the period January and April 15th when tax refunds are paid out. With a simpler tax code and more accurate holding tables, which we've done this year, that $2.2 billion in overpayments and refunds is probably going to decrease. That may shift some of the money till next year. So there is uncertainty, and we won't know the full impact and detail of the tax reforms that take effect this year in January of 14. Until we get all the tax returns and tax refunds done in April 15, a year from now. So we do need to see where we are as far as revenue, the actual effect of the tax reform, before any further changes are made.
You've been an office holder. You've worked for and given money to get people elected to state government. You worked to get Pat McCrory elected, if I'm not mistaken, governor, and he appointed you to be his state budget director. So some people have said this is quid pro quo. Do you see this as that, or do you see this as an opportunity? Do you see this as a reward? How do you view your position and your appointment to the position of budget director?
I'll go back to say I see it as a public service. I mean, when I was a 28-year-old in 1985, I served Governor Jim Martin as a special counsel in the governor's office, working on boards and commissions and judicial appointments. I certainly had not given any money back then, but I believed in public service back then as well. There's a long history in the state of North Carolina of business people serving the state. Very often, many of them have been big donors or served in office themselves. Erskine Bowles spent millions of dollars running for the U.S. Senate, served in the Clinton administration, but no one questioned him serving as president of the university system as being something he bought or a quid pro quo. They saw as a further public service by Erskine Bowles, and I agree with that. And C.D. Spanger, another president of the university system, he was a major Democratic donor, a very successful businessman, but he cared about education, and he served the state as president of the university, not because he was a donor.
Why do you think you've been a target? Because people have really come down on you.
Well, it means you got to think about what you say when you mean people. If you talk to the Democratic elected officials who have served and worked with Dan Blue, He was the dean of the Wake County delegation when I was a freshman in 1989. He was the first African-American speaker of the House. Dan Blue and I have a very good working relationship. I very much appreciate his advice when I was a young person, a young legislator, and worked with on issues where we agree and times disagree. Governor Jim Hunt. I serve Governor Jim Martin. I'm proud to say I have a good working relationship with Governor Jim Hunt. Have served on boards with him, have engaged with him on the education issue. So I can go down a long list of Chief Justice Burley Mitchell. So the elected Democratic officials who know me and have worked with, I'm glad to say there's mutual respect. We can work together, and when we disagree, it's respectful disagreement. We say some people, being perfectly blunt, is the organized left funded by the progressive foundations who have a policy agenda that's different from the Locke Foundation. They support Democrats. I support Republicans, so they attack me. It's a very narrow, very well-funded, but very vocal group that criticize and attack me.
Well, two of the biggest
people I work with.
Two of the biggest people who have gone after you. The New Yorker did a major profile on you called State for Sale. Then Bill Moyers on PBS did a program called State of Conflict, which looked at North Carolina's move to the right, and in which they pointed to you as a wealthy individual who spent unprecedented amounts of money to promote causes that you believe in and to get people elected. And Moyers went on to say that his program offered a case study of what may be the direction of American politics for years, perhaps decades to come, meaning the influence of big money by wealthy individuals on government. I'm sure that you take issue with all of this. But does he have a point?
No, he doesn't. And again, neither Jane Mayer or Bill Moyers are what we consider objective journalism. To put it politely, I think it's called advocacy journalism. And some of the things they wrote were not merely half-truths and distortions. They were outright false statements being reported. One common technique that both of them use is that they will say that Art Pope donated millions of dollars to Republican candidates and public policy groups. They will whisper the public policy group. The fact of the matter is, I've not given millions of dollars ever in my entire life to candidates. I'm not the biggest donor to Republican candidates in North Carolina, and I'm certainly not the biggest donor at all. Again, Erskine Bowles spent $6 million on his Senate campaign. John Edwards spent about $6 million on his U.S. Senate campaign. Bill Faison, a legislator who was a progressive Democrat, loaned his campaign $500,000 in 2012, saying he's going to use it to elect Democrats. But, of course, the Bill Moyers, Jane Mayers, and the local left don't criticize them for buying offices, even though they gave far more money than I ever did. So it is because they cannot debate, or they're either not willing to debate or not successful to debate in public policy issues. It's because their candidates, the Democrat candidates, lose Republican candidates, rather than debate the issues, they attack the supporters, they attack the messengers. And that's what I'm having to deal with.
Art Pope is the state budget director of North Carolina. We'll continue our conversation with him about this and many other things as we continue the hour here. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
More of this archive edition of Charlotte Talks coming up in just a moment here on 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Monarch Mental Health and Human Services, with an emphasis on putting the care into mental health care. Details at monarchnc.org/cares. Coming up next, in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists will join Diane for a review of the top national news stories of the week, including President Obama asking Congress for nearly $4 billion to address the border crisis, the House and Senate moving to renew the Highway Trust Fund, and recreational marijuana sales beginning in Washington State. Some of the stories we'll discuss in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show here on 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte Talks returns in just a moment.
What would $950 pay for? I really prefer to think of our card paying for Click and Clack's coffee machine or their dental care or something.
Perhaps the fabric in the seatbelts can be recycled into NPR tote bags.
I'm Lauren Brown.
And her husband, Lenny Hort.
And we donated our 1995 Toyota Camry station wagon to public radio.
Find out how you can help at WFAE.org. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Back to our conversation now with State Budget Director Art Pope. A reminder that this was recorded and originally aired in April before the budget was submitted to the General Assembly, but it provides some good insights into the budget process, competing priorities, and insights into Mr. Pope himself. Just prior to the break, we were talking about his withering criticism coming from some areas of the country and some areas of the state with regard to the use of money in political campaigns, and particularly profiling you as somebody who is controlling the state, the puppeteer, so to speak, as many of them have referred to you. But when you look, take Art Pope out of the equation. When you look at the Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case and their ruling that limits on the total amount of money that donors can give to all candidates, committees, and political parties, all of that is unconstitutional. You can't limit that anymore. Doesn't that put wealthy individuals in the catbird seat? Doesn't that give them more power than average people who can't do that? Doesn't that negate one man, one vote?
No, not at all. And in fact, for Jane Mayers and Bill Moyers who say the state's been bought by Republicans or by me, you would think if the state was bought, it would go to the highest bidder. In the 2010 election, which both Moyers and Mayers focused on, the Democrat Party and its candidates outspent Republicans $15.3 million.
But wasn't that election smaller donors? In other words, it was maybe more money in the aggregate, but it came in smaller pieces from more people.
But once again, the Democrat Party has more big-dollar donors than the Republican Party did. A gentleman named Robert Page, a retailer of Replacement Limited, gave more money to Democrats than I gave to Republicans. Again, the Democrats have more large donors. But likewise, when you look at the public policy debate and the funding for that, then the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation gives millions of dollars more a year to liberal progressive groups than the Polk Foundation does to conservative groups. The Polk Foundation does give about $2.3 million a year to the John Locke Foundation, one of the leading limited government conservative groups. But the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation gives $2.6 to $2.9 million a year to North Carolina Center for Justice, which is the biggest progressive group.
But isn't that wrong on both sides of the aisle? Because it seems to me,
why is it wrong to fund a public policy debate? I don't question the Reynolds Foundation's right to give for a public policy debate. They just attacked the Polk Foundation for doing it.
But when you're talking about these foundations are pretty much organized, run, and funded by high-dollar individuals. So it's not just a foundation giving $2 or $3 million. It's a person filtering it through.
Actually, in the case of the Reynolds Foundation, they're giving away money earned by a tobacco fortune back in the 1930s. So they're a little bit different. The Polk Foundation is funded by myself and my family, so the current generation is funding this.
But if you were sitting there making $50,000 a year or $40,000 a year, and that was your total source of income, and the only wealth that you could point to was your $110,000 house, how is that person supposed to feel about his or her impact on public policy and on politics and who wins elections when somebody who is a multi-millionaire or billionaire can give several million dollars, $10 million, $20 million to a cause or a candidate? Doesn't that outweigh their ability to vote and have an impact? It becomes an oligarchy, doesn't it?
For two reasons. What is the money being spent on? When people talk about buying an election, it raises images of literally giving someone $20 per vote or a bottle of liquor the way they supposedly did in the old days if you voted for their candidate. The money going for public policy debate is going to the battle of ideas, the marketplace of ideas, present different alternatives, different policies that people can be formed and choose upon. The money goes to the candidates. Again, it's used because I've been a candidate. It goes to direct mail. It goes to TV advertisement. It goes to getting around the state to meet people at town hall meetings and forums. And again, if it really what you're saying is true, that the money went to the highest bidder, then the Democrats never would have lost the 2010 election. But let me ask you this, Mike. Who do you work for? You work for the University Radio Foundation, Inc. You work for a corporation, and your corporation has donations going to it. So you can have this show interview me, interview the governor, interview Democrats, and get information out to your listeners. What is wrong with that? By the way, none of the things I've ever done have been under Citizens United. But Citizens United held that people who organize and associate together through corporations have free speech rights, too. If Citizens United were to decide it the other way and corporations that had no free speech rights, then the Federal Election Commission or North Carolina General Assembly could pass a law that says Mike Collins and WFAE may not mention the name of a candidate 60 days before the election or 30 days before the primary election. So you cannot mention Pat McCrory by name or Tom Tillis by name or Kay Hagan by name during this 30 days leading up to the election. That's a restriction on your free speech right, and it restricts what your listeners can hear.
Well, what about the – there's a lot of other things going on here, too, that people have been critical of. What about the perceived conflict of interest? You're a guy that is the state budget director. You've made these contributions either personally or through your foundation. You worked voluntarily to elect the governor to office, and now you're the state budget director. Is there a conflict of interest there for somebody who has given to particular causes to then come to a position where they can influence those causes at the state government level?
I voluntarily filed a statement of economic interest disclosing all my economic interests. I wasn't required to by law. I did that voluntarily. And there's not a single thing I've been involved in as state budget director that poses a conflict.
Would you feel the same way if George Soros had become the state budget director of North Carolina?
Well, you've had state budget directors. Again, John A. Williams was Governor Hunt. I can't remember whether he's the chief of staff or the budget director, but Governor Hunt had prominent donors who served in his administration. All administrations do that. The same thing that motivates me to give to a candidate or support public policy is trying to improve the lives of our citizens, the lives of our people. So I don't do it merely by writing a check. I don't do it merely by supporting a public policy foundation. I do it by running for office, being elected, including by Democrats, to serve in the General Assembly. I did as a 28-year-old serving Governor Martin, and I'm now doing as a 57-year-old serving Governor McCrory, but more importantly, serving the state. So it's not a quid pro quo or conflict. It's the motivation to serve the public, trying to improve our lives and improve our state and the opportunities for future generations.
I've done this long enough to know that there are conspiracy theories that abound about everyone and everything, and most of them have no foundation in fact. But some have said, some of these conspiracy theories have said, that you are not unlike a puppet master pulling all the strings. Others have suggested that you supported McCrory's run for governor in exchange for letting you pull those strings. And others have asserted that you are so powerful that you can't be crossed. You are untouchable. Do those claims surprise you? Have you heard them? Do you understand how some people could reach those conclusions?
Well, again, when you say some people, you're primarily talking about left-wing bloggers. And no, I really don't pay much attention to left-wing bloggers any more than it used to be. They sit around the coffee pot in the morning and mutter, or have a beer at the back of the bar and mutter, you know, just among themselves. Now they can post it on the internet and it gets spread all over. You can Google search it. So no, I really do not spend much time worrying about that. And then, as pointed out there, those are well-paid and orchestrated by the left-of-center foundations and policy groups who choose to attack the messenger, including me, rather than debating the merits of the issue. As to Governor McCrory, I actually supported Bob Orr for governor against Pat McCrory in 2008. So I supported his primary opponent. Once he was the nominee, I started to get to know him better, and I was glad to support him. In 2012, I gave him, I think, $4,000 in the primary, $4,000 for the general election. There are lots of people, both Democrat and Republicans, who give the maximum amount allowed in the state. I really was not involved in his campaign at all in 2012. He did ask me to be involved in his transition, which, because my background in both the executive branch of Governor Martin, as well as being a former legislator, my business experience. And then during the course of the transition, he had the confidence to ask me to serve as budget director, and it's hard to decline an opportunity to serve the public when the governor's asking you. So that's the way that worked. There was no quid pro quo discussion whatsoever, no discussion about budget director in 2008 when I was supporting Bob Orr, none in 2012. It wasn't until about the middle of the transition the governor approached me about the topic.
As budget director, a lot of things have to come through you and cross your desk. And in March, you sent the University of North Carolina system back to the drawing board with their budget request. They came in asking, I think, for an 11.3% increase over their current funding level. This year, they received $2.5 billion, that's with a B, in state money for operations, and $64 million more for building repairs and construction. And you called their request for more money not realistic. I think that you have been a longtime critic of the UNC system. If that's true, have those feelings played into this, or is this simply not realistic given the current money situation?
I am a longtime supporter of the university system. As a member of the legislature, I always serve on the education committee. I've always striven to improve our education, starting with K-12 and the community college and the university. It's because I support the university, both as a former legislator and as an individual, that you sometimes do have to criticize them, because we have seen a rising cost of higher education, and it's becoming almost unaffordable for our students, even those on financial aid, and those, especially for those who have to take after loans. But so I'm a supporter of the university. So it's not because I'm a critic of the university. I'm a supporter of the university. But when it came to the budget proposal they sent over this year, their request for the Repair and Innovation Fund was around $173 million. Well, the entire Repair and Innovation Fund last year, this current year, was $150 million, of which the university got $60 million of that. So, yes, it was unrealistic to ask that much for repair and innovations and to have a capital increase in that, given the realities of where the budget was. By the way, the Governor McCrory's budget gave the university more repair and renovation money they received in 6 years. So, yes, I was asking them to be more realistic and more responsible.
Well, go ahead.
I said they also failed to follow the express statutory requirement. They didn't have any details, and therefore pay increase for their employees. They were supposed to give details on how and where the repair and renovation money would be spent, not just a lump sum. So, yes, I did ask them to go back and, with approval of the governor, to go back and rework their numbers and come up with a more realistic budget proposal.
In the memo that you wrote to them suggesting they come back with that more realistic budget request, you talked about some of the things you just said, the spiraling cost of education, the increased cost to students and their parents, growing personal debt, increasing demands on the state budget, and that none of those things can continue indefinitely. A lot of people would agree with you on that. Particularly on the increasing costs of college, do you believe that the university has a tin ear, or that they don't care about those things, or that they don't even understand those things, or that has this come as news to them?
No, I'm glad to say there's a very active debate going on in the university community, at least at the Board of Governors, Board of Trustees levels, and the senior administrators. President Tom Ross, president of the university system, asked me to serve on the strategic advisory committee for the university system back in the fall of 2012, which I did, and we were having those discussions back then. I had to step down from that group before they did their final recommendations because I've moved over to state budget director. So, no, this is very much an ongoing debate in the nation and among the governing bodies of the university system. Now, everyone wants more money for their institution, their agency. The university faculty administrators want more money for the university. The teachers want more money for teachers. The Department of Public Safety wants more money for criminal justice and corrections, judiciary. That's a hard part of this job. The state budget office has to balance all those competing needs, whereas an individual agency can just be an advocate for themselves. So that is the challenge that the governor has and the General Assembly has in enacting a balanced budget that balances all the needs, not just the university, but also those needs of Medicaid, not just the judiciary, but the needs of the Department of Transportation. Mm-hmm. So they're all competing needs that have to be balanced.
UNC President Tom Ross, in responding to your suggestion that it's not reasonable, said he wasn't trying to be unreasonable, because if they were to come in and ask for what we really needed to make up for inflation and try to do what we need to do for retention and to fight off competition, it would be a number that would probably be unreasonable. Could this first figure that they came in with simply have been the first shot over the bow in a negotiation process?
I would absolutely be shocked if that were the case. No, seriously, that was meant in humor.
Yes, I got that.
It is not unusual for agencies to make and universities to make a high dollar request, so that there's a negotiating point and they end up somewhere in the middle. So that's not unusual. However, I'm responsible for preparing a balanced budget to submit to the governor, for the governor to review all the options. And we need realistic options for the governor to evaluate and decide upon and submit that to the General Assembly. I don't have the luxury of negotiating. I've got hard numbers to present to the governor the governor to make the decision on.
I have 90 seconds. You're the chairman of the president, the chairman and president of the John William Pope Foundation, which bears your father's name, describes itself as working to advance individual freedom, personal responsibility, and supporting a network of organizations in the state that advocate for free markets, limited government, and government transparency. And the foundation funds think tanks to translate ideas into policy and to ensure that tax dollars are wisely spent. How do you determine that?
That's one of the challenges, and that's why I do believe in a vigorous public policy debate rather than attacking people's character and motivation. I think both Democrats and Republicans, liberal and conservatives, all want to improve society, but we need to have a debate on what those policies will best improve society. We need to look at how money is actually being spent and look at the actual results as a continuing, ongoing procedure. It's easy to measure input, how much money you're spending on something, but how much is it really improving people's lives? That is a challenge. That's why I think a vigorous public policy debate, both left and right, conservative and liberal, is helpful. And that's why in the state budget office, we consider real objective numbers. What are the results? What are the costs? In order to choose between various alternatives. And Mike, so often there's not one single right answer. It's a trade-off. There's the advantage to one approach, but it comes at a cost to others. So you need to evaluate that. You need to have pilot programs. You need to fund efforts to discover, learn, and then discuss these issues. Then the people decide the elections, and then the elected officials implement what they see as the best solution.
That's North Carolina State Budget Director Art Pope, recorded in April. The legislature continues to debate the $21.1 billion budget. WFAE News is keeping an eye on the negotiations, and Monday on Charlotte Talks, we'll talk with Governor Pat McCrory.